You're listening to the Save the Marriage Podcast. Your marriage can be saved and strengthened if you have the right information. Join Dr. Lee Baucom as he explores ways for you to improve your relationship and your life, starting right now.
Hi, this is Lee Baucom, and you are with us on the Save the Marriage Podcast. This is the podcast to get you the information you need to save your marriage. I trust that you're here because you continue to work on that marriage and find better ways, better strategies on how to both save your marriage, improve your relationship, and improve yourself. We use that as our methodology. We use all three approaches. And today I have the great honor of talking with one of my team of coaches, Nina Potter. Nina is an outstanding relationship coach and has lots of experience and right now is writing a book on how to never be unhappy in a relationship again. Pretty big statement and one that she's going to back up today. She's going to tell us what she means by that and how what you do affects that, how you view yourself, how you're entering into the relationship changes that. I'm going to ask her lots of questions that are going to give you excellent advice. I hope you get a lot out of this interview. So now let's go to that interview with Nina. Nina, thank you for being here. Glad you're here. And, you know, one of the things that I think is very helpful for people is to have an idea of how you got to here. So let's talk some about how you got here, both as a person and as in your profession as a coach, and just kind of let people get to know you.
Well, thank you, Lee. Well, I grew up with very low self-esteem, which I'm sure a lot of people can relate to. I wanted to know how to get love. Like, how do I get people to love me? And I started out reading all the wrong materials to get the wrong information. I was reading fashion magazines, teen magazines, adult novels, which are generally about people who are really messed up. So learning a lot of really bad habits. I got married in my early 20s, and as soon as I got married, I stopped searching. I stopped studying. I basically thought, oh, this is it. This is the end all be all. And I didn't do anything. I didn't work on my marriage in any way. And I chose my mate by chemistry alone. And then I never did any really growth of myself throughout that marriage. I never learned how to play in it. I just was like all about working and paying the bills and you know, going about the technical aspects of life and never really got into the juicy emotional part of marriage. And after 10 years, my marriage failed. So there I was at 30 years old, and my husband left me, I'm pretty sure now, for another person. He denied it at the time, but I realized in retrospect that, you know, there had to have been someone behind it. And that's fine. It worked out to be a really good thing for me, because what it did was it sent me on a deep discovery mission that's been for the last 25 years, learning to know myself, learning about healthy life and love skills. So what I wanted to know wasn't really in a school. So I was busy learning what I needed to know, not what a school told me that this is what I need to know. So I spent most of that time having failed long-term relationships with more unconsciously chosen partners where, you know, I look back and I think I learned so much about those relationships, and they benefited me in the long run so much that I have absolutely no regrets about any of them. I think that it was a perfect training ground for what I do now. I have so much empathy and understanding because I've been there. I've walked in the shoes. So 15 years ago, I decided to formulate, a personal growth formalized plan. So I went to coaching school and started a coaching practice. And then 7 years ago, I came full circle and started training as a relationship coach and found that this was my true calling. It was there all the time since I was a child that I wanted to know about relationships and how to make them work. So I consciously chose my current life partner, and I get to practice everything that I learn on my own relationship. So I know what works, and I know that your material works extremely well. It's just been a pleasure to work with it. So I love the fact that as an education junkie, I will never run out of things to learn. Learn about couples, learn about love, and the human need to bond. So every week is it's an eye-opening experience.
So talk a little bit more. You said that your early days, you were choosing people unconsciously. What do you mean by that?
Well, I was going by chemistry alone. I was infatuated by the chemicals that were being released in my brain because I was physically attracted. And, once you start getting into the relationship, then other chemistry comes in, the cuddle hormones, the hormones that make you want to attach. And that's what led the relationship to go into marriage. Because, it was kind of the thing to do. It was the time. And I didn't realize that I never looked at my mate from a perspective of like, where am I going and who should go with me? And is this partner right for me? Am I right for this partner? And it turned out he was a wonderful guy. It's just that we were not compatible at all based on what we wanted out of life and where we wanted to go. Completely incompatible from that perspective.
So looking back on that, there is some, you talked about the incompatibilities, and and part of what you saw for him was he chose somebody else he felt more compatible. As you know, a lot of people who come to us are trying to figure out what do you do when things are in trouble. An option that is there for everybody is to say, we're just incompatible.
Right. And I would add, my parents at 88 years old, have been married over 60 years. They are completely incompatible in every way, politically, religiously. One's a chronic doer. One's extremely, stressed if she has two things to do in a day. So incompatibility is no reason to split. The reason that we split was because I had no skills. I had no relationship skills. I had no information. Had I had the information from your program back then and learned how to have the relationship, we might still be together. In fact, my current mate has a lot of personality traits that my husband had in my 20s. So the incompatibility was no reason. What I do is I look back and say, well, what did I learn? That was 30 years ago. What are the good things that came out of it? It's too late for me to fix that now. And now I realize that I need to learn how to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think a lot of times there's the myth of compatibility, and what that the myth of compatibility is, this other person should be a perfect match for us. We should have these, some of our politics should match, or all of our politics should match, and all of our thoughts should be in sync. And in reality, I think that's a huge myth.
Totally.
I think there are some value places where couples can be just incompatible with values, and that's different than incompatible, as you talk about your parents, is incompatible in how they do life. And one of the other pieces, I think, is that complementary is possible. You talked about your parents,
yes.
And compatible and complementary are really tough concepts because we have these myths that run around.
Right.
And I think you just exposed that one or two, really, that there's this incompatibility that may actually be a complementarity.
Yes.
And then that way they balance. And in another, that there are some other places that get us into trouble. You talked about a lack of skills.
Yes. And what you just said is one of them. I didn't have the understanding back then that our differences were something to be celebrated, and I recognize that now with my partner now, who's again, he's very similar to the man I was married to in my 20s, and now I find myself when I'm not happy, I find that it's because I'm forgetting that those things that I'm mad at him for not doing for me, it's like, oh, I need him in my life to mirror that way, because I'm over the top in one way. I need him to be that way to help to balance me. It was one of the reasons I was attracted to him when we were dating, because I recognized that I actually need that complementarity. It's just that sometimes I forget, and that's where having tools comes in. By having the tools, I remember before I mess up the relationship. Mm-hmm. I remember before I go off and be all unhappy and go, oh, wait a minute, I actually need this in my life. And I look at myself and say, oh, I can do this differently. I can appreciate him for who he is because it's actually good for me.
Which brings us to a topic that you're writing about. You're writing a book called How to Never Be Unhappy in a Relationship Again. And it sounds like you may be beginning to talk about what that's about. So say something more about how you can never be unhappy in a relationship again.
Great. Well, happiness is an inside job. And as long as you're expecting outside events and conditions to determine your happiness, you're going to be constantly disappointed and probably very insecure. So being happy from the inside is a practice. It's a practice. It's something that you want to remind yourself to do as often as possible, to look at how am I showing up as far as my needs, in terms of what judgments am I making, what demands and expectations am I putting out there of other people to make myself happy? And what do I need to do internally that I can count on? I can count on myself to make me happy. So in the book, I explain the how and what those practices need to be. And then, of course, doing it is up to each of us to do it. So I explain the how, but if you just read it, that's not going to help. You have to actually do the practices.
Sure. Information is just information until you
exactly
apply. So right. Talk some about how you can do that. What are some pieces you can do?
Well, I found that well-being is actually a natural state that we can access if you're not too stubborn to allow it. So I have a little post-it note on my computer that in a spot where I tend to look at a lot, and it just says, well-being with an exclamation point. And I have it there to remind me that anytime I'm thrown a little off and I find myself not being happy or not in well-being, I look at that and I smile. I go, yeah, that's right. And I sort of take a breath and go, yeah, I can access that well-being that's there all the time. No matter what's going on around me, there is an inner place of well-being that's always there if I go to look for it and if I find it. And I find that it has never failed yet in the time that I've done that. So there's a key to all this, and that is not to trade your well-being or your happiness for anything you're experiencing outside yourself. Don't trade it. If your mate's doing something that makes you crazy, don't trade your well-being for that. So, I mean, it would be nice to have a little example here. Is there anything in your life or maybe in a client, that if you can think of a client, or maybe one of your kids where they there's something that makes them unhappy that they're trading their unhappiness for?
Well, let's talk. I mean, I hear a lot from people who tell me that, you know, their spouse is driving them crazy. They're doing all these things, you know, they're neglecting them, they're not talking to them, they're always looking at their iPhone, they're completely distracted, and they're miserable. That's their starting point. And so part of what they want to do is to save their relationship, but what they're really telling me is they just feel like they're a non-entity with their spouse, and that makes them feel miserable.
Yeah, they're feeling discounted. And many of us fall prey to this. It's sort of a socially indoctrinated concept of victimhood. So if you think your well-being is dependent on your partner paying attention to you and giving you attention, I'm not saying that's not a wonderful thing and that you don't want to do, you take actions to help you get it. You definitely want to do that. You want to take some action. But in order to be in well-being and happiness about it, you need to stop arguing for this limitation that your well-being and your happiness has to come from outside. That whole victim idea where you're being victimized by them not paying attention to you, it makes you powerless and it's scary. It puts you into fear. And when we're in fear, we tend to react in a way that doesn't get us what we want. If we can pull back, find our inner well-being, our love for ourselves, then we can respond in a loving way that's 10 times more likely to get us what we actually want.
Okay, so let's say that somebody's hearing that and they're going, well, wait, I signed up for this marriage thing because I love this person and they made me happy. And I thought, well, we'll be happy for life. Now we're here. Where'd they miss the boat?
Right. Well, in not having the skills we need and understanding how relationships work and bonding, we take our spouse for granted. We don't have good communication skills. We don't have empathy. We don't love ourselves enough in order to love the other person. We hold grudges. We have all these things that we don't take responsibility for. We're always pointing our finger. And I love that concept of when you point your finger at someone or something, you've always got three fingers pointing back at yourself. And that never fails to make me laugh. When I'm pointing my finger at my mate and I'll stop and all of a sudden, there it is. I look down and I see those three fingers pointing back at myself and think, okay, what am I not doing for myself that I'm mad at him for? It's amazing.
Okay, that last phrase, I think you might want to unpack a little bit. What am I not doing for myself that I'm expecting them to do?
And that's taking care of my inner happiness. I'm going to talk a little bit about attitude here because we get to choose our attitude. If you've ever heard of Viktor Frankl, he wrote the book Man's Search for Meaning, where he was in the most inhospitable environment I think, you know, pretty much conceivable. Was his life was being threatened hourly. He had zero control over anything external in his life, and yet he found inner power in his choice to choose his attitudes. So they could control everything external, but he could control his own attitude. So his choice was for dignity and love. And he would look for opportunities to help other people in the camp and extend love to them. So we are in control of our attitudes, our intentions, and our desires. But we have all these beliefs and thoughts that pop up. And it's kind of like black ice on a road. We're driving down the road, not paying attention, and all of a sudden this ice throws us into the ditch. Now, we can choose to keep driving in this bumpy, rocky ditch, which a lot of us choose to do when we're in victimhood. Oh, my spouse isn't giving me what I want. It's all their fault. But we can choose to get back up on that road and have a comfortable ride until the next time we're thrown back into the ditch. It's our choice. Our mates are going to make mistakes. And when we can approach them from a place of love and empathy and understanding, then we can start getting the behaviors that we think. And I don't even like to say the word getting because that's not what it's about. It's about experiencing. We can start experiencing the love that they actually do have for us when we're giving our love to them.
So I use the three rubrics, the three C's saving a marriage, and that's changing yourself or connecting with your spouse, the first one, mm-hmm. changing right. yourself, and then creating a new path. And I don't mean those in sequential order. I mean all of them all at once.
Right.
And so part of what you're talking about here of what's going on inside of you is a bridge point between changing yourself and connecting with your spouse. If your attitude is one of you keep hurting me and you're making me miserable, then your ability to connect is next to zero.
Exactly.
And so the change there is to say, I do have some options here. I do have a choice.
Right. And we can't control what they do. we can only control what we do and what we know, what we believe, think, and choose. So we need to take ownership of those choices so that we can respond. There's a wonderful quote from Doc Childre at the Institute of Heart Math. He says, "Nothing changes until we change, and when we change, everything changes." So our spouses, our parents, our kids, our coworkers, they're all responding to who we are and how we're being and how we're showing up. And we're constantly projecting our judgments onto others. And I want to make a little distinction because when we're thinking that our spouse is wrong in some way, a lot of times, that's judgment. When we say, well, they're wrong, it's a judgment. And a lot of people say, well, I need to make judgments because, people do bad things. Well, there's a difference between judgment and discernment. Discernment is making a distinction of what my preferences are. And of course, we're going to be making discernments about our preferences. But judgments are where we're saying something's good or bad, and that the person is bad for doing it. And they're generally a reflection of our own judgments about ourselves. They're about disowning a part of who we've been. An example I give is, and this is often called shadow, if anyone wants to learn more about that. An example of this is, in my life, sometimes I get mad at my mate for being what I call lazy. To me, I think that's, of course, this is one of those compatibilities. I need his rest. I need him to be restful. But what I'll do is I'll go into lazy. I think, oh, you're being lazy. And what this is a judgment that comes from my childhood where, I wasn't expected to do much, and I'd be sitting around watching Hogan's Heroes on TV, and my mother would want me to set the table. Very small task. And, oh, I would grumble and groan and drag my feet and didn't want to do it. Well, as an adult, I look back on that, and I'm judging myself. I'm saying, well, that was bad behavior, and I shouldn't have done that. And then what I do is I disown it. I don't want to be that person. And so I project that onto my spouse. And once I recognize I'm doing that, I can pull back, recognize that that is actually a gift, that he's showing me a place where I can have acceptance for myself, that I can look at where am I doing that in my life. And how can I accept and love myself for doing that? And that's, again, where those three fingers are pointing back at myself.
So let's start unpacking that just a bit. So, mm-hmm. Part of what we're saying is that what's going on inside of us, sometimes when we don't want to claim it, when that's the shadow, we don't want to claim it, we stick it out onto somebody else, our spouse, our kids, our boss, our wherever, and we make them the bad person. We make them the person who's making us miserable, and we project it onto them. That's the shadow part. What's the starting point? If somebody's listening to that, and the difficult thing is we're all convinced that A, we're innocent,
right,
and B, the other person is not. And so part of what the task is pulling back and saying, what's my responsibility in that? So we a few minutes ago established, Viktor Frankl is one of my favorite authors, and we established his kind of thing, that our last choice is in our attitude. The one thing that nobody can take from us is how we choose to have an attitude towards something. And so we've already established that. But in the meantime, we've got these layer upon layer of beliefs that it ain't me, it's the other person, or I don't need to change, the other person does. How do we start reclaiming our power? As you said, that makes us powerless. How do we start that reclaiming our power and at the same time reclaiming our responsibility?
Yeah, I think when we stop seeing ourselves as separate from each other and separate from our source, then we can drop our fear and have an incredible capacity for love. So the opposite of love is fear. If you take a moment to notice what's underneath our displeasure with ourselves and with the other, we'll find that there's a fear of being separate or alone. If you think of a child in their worst state of separation anxiety, if you've ever seen, what are they, like a 2-year-old, it's sad to see their panic. And when we see that, our instinct is kind of to offer reassurance and compassion. And yet when it's an adult or ourselves, we forget that we need reassurance and compassion. And it needs to start with ourselves. So starting to practice seeing ourselves as connected to all, connected to everyone, and to our source. And part of that goes into finding our well-being, and that's there when you're not separate. Starting to allow and accept and love yourself along with your mates and your children and your coworkers and your neighbors and all those people. It starts with you. When you have self-acceptance, then it's a lot easier. When we can forgive ourselves for not living up to our expectations, we can move beyond even needing to forgive. I teach my clients about the baby pooping in its diaper. We don't blame the baby for pooping in its diaper because that's at its level of development. That's all it could do. We change the diaper, we move on, and we train it. We train the baby over time to get potty trained, hopefully in a loving and consistent way rather than a punitive and critical way. That tends to make the process take a lot longer. But having that compassion that we would have for the baby pooping in a diaper, recognizing that, well, right now where I am, my level of development is right here, right now, and that's all I can do. And I can learn the next step. I can get a pair of pull-ups and take the next step, and I can train myself. But having that compassion and not blaming, you'd never blame the baby.
Okay, so let's forward it a few years. Now we've got a 5-year-old, and the 5-year-old poops in his pants.
Yeah.
And suddenly, we're headed out the door. We've got to be somewhere in 10 minutes, and we were already running late, and there it is. We've got a mess to clean up. At that point, it's not compassion.
You know, right.
It's why did you do this to me? And for me, I think that's a lot of times where we see our spouse. Instead of the innocent baby, we see him as the 5-year-old who just messed up our departure.
Our plans.
How do we get beyond that?
Well, we can't make them change. You know, it's they're who they're going to be. We can only change ourselves and our attitude toward them. And we all develop in different life stages. Just like the 5-year-old, we don't know what the situation is. If they had an illness, you know, what was prompting this? If it's a chronic issue, what's underneath it? So if we look at that as a level of development or stages, we all have a different conscious development in different areas of our life. Some of us are really, really good in our work, or we're really, really good at a sport, but we might be really underdeveloped in relationships or relating. So understanding that we have these different areas, we all need to grow and change. All of us, our spouses, ourselves, and we get to decide when and how. When we start saying the other person has to do this now, it's the root of making ourselves unhappy. When we're trying to tell our mate that they need to develop and they need to grow on our timetable, it makes us unhappy. When I stop that nonsense and love them as they are, whether it's my spouse or my parent or the neighbor, then I'm back into well-being. When I let go of telling them how they should be, and I just look back and say, well, how do I need to be? What do I need to how do I need to lovingly respond in this situation? Okay, my spouse, my 5-year-old, has just made it very inconvenient for me, and I need to just choose my attitude, find the love, find the compassion, and I will have much better results in the long term. You know, if I overreact out of fear and anger and pain, I'm going to set them back in their own development. And I'm ultimately shooting myself in the foot, because the next time it's going to be worse. If I respond in a loving way, it allows them the opportunity to grow and develop so that it doesn't happen next time.
So I guess I'm wondering, and I'm assuming that as people are listening to that, they're going, so what you're saying is I should expect nothing from my spouse, that whatever they do is okay, and I've just got to love them through that.
Oh, if we were only that wonderful, wouldn't
it? Oh, I'm not sure. I mean, right. Maybe not. But, yeah. You know, let's take it back to that five-year-old. Yeah. Can I have no expectation that that child is going to start using the potty? Can I have no expectation that my spouse is going to, you know, whatever?
Yes. Well, and of course, we're going to be doing what we can to help them to grow and change. We're going to guide them. We're going to lovingly model for them. People learn so much better by good modeling than they ever be by telling them what to do. And I think anyone with kids notices that. Kids will model good and bad. I mean, things that we don't want them to model, they will model. We see that quite often. So when we can model the behavior that we want from them, we're so much more likely to get it. So it's not that we don't want it. We certainly want those things. It's just a matter of looking at what's the best way to experience it. And what I found, and what my clients are finding as they put this into practice, is that by focusing on themselves, by modeling what it is they want, and this includes having good boundaries, and that's a whole nother topic. By modeling what it is that we want, by making it clear what our request is. I think that's a big part of this, is we tend to get critical and we complain rather than making a request. Making the request of the five-year-old or the adult, saying, it would really be helpful to me. I'd really like it if you would use the bathroom before we need to leave. You'll find that, you know, it will help mommy a whole lot. You can ask your spouse, I would really appreciate it if you would, whatever it is you want them to do, as a request, just because it would make you happy. People want to make the people they care about happy. When we give a lot of excuses and reasons why, it can often get lost. But when it's just basically, it would make me so happy if you would, in a kind request, you're far more likely to get the outcome you're looking for than by criticizing and complaining.
And the fact is that every complaint is an unspoken request.
Exactly.
It's in there. And so what you're saying is, let's just be clear about that and be upfront. Could you please, instead of, I can't believe you do.
That's right. And waiting for our spouse to change before we take the necessary action to save our marriage or to do what we need to do to improve our relationship is a lot like punching a hole in our own lifeboat.
Say more about that.
By expecting them to start, we're sunk. By waiting for them to start, if our marriage is in trouble or if our relationship is starting to fail, if we wait for them to make the change, we have no hope, because the change needs to start with us. It's not going to start with them. It needs to start with us.
Well, let's push that a little harder, because I think that's one of the most common things I hear, is people say, you know, I can't do anything because my spouse doesn't want to save their marriage. I can't do anything until my spouse does X, Y, Z. I can't do anything until. That's a trap, and that's what you're pointing to, is that whether the other person changes or not, you can start down that path.
Exactly. And in fact, it's the only thing that's going to make it change. If you don't step up there's a very high probability that your relationship will fail if you don't step up. And that's the analogy of the sinking lifeboat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's the I will if you will approach. And mm-hmm. you know what is always interesting to me is so many times you don't realize it, but both people in the relationship are saying I will if you will, and then the person takes action, and then all of a sudden the other person is on board much more quickly. But somebody is waiting for a shift, and they're always waiting initially for the shift from the other person. So let's kind of rewind a few minutes back. You were talking about fear and love. And one of the things that I think a lot of people don't realize about the brain, not just about our mind, but the brain, is that our brain is only capable of really of those two things, love or fear. And when we're talking about love, we're not really talking about the gushy feeling of love,
right.
but
right.
choosing to act in ways that are in the best interest of another person. You know, there, and it really, it's if you want to boil it down even further, it's abundance or scarcity, love mm-hmm. and fear. And what most people, you know, I've said this many times in meetings, and people say, well, what about anger? Not recognizing that anger really is fear. That's where that comes
exactly.
from. And so they start trying to find another emotion that's outside of those two. And that really is it. The love comes from the more developed part of our brain, the part that we humans think that we're always logical. That's where that comes from. And the fear comes from the most primitive parts.
Right. Yeah, and that's the difference between, it's like a second and a half. They've actually measured it. Our fear response will be automatic. It happens automatically. If you're driving down the road and a ball comes out between two cars, our body stops the car before we can even think of it. Our foot's on the gas because we know that after a ball, there's a kid chasing it. So that fear is instant and automatic. So when we're in an interaction with our mate and we react with fear or from fear, it's going to have an escalating, or I should say, you know, like a downward spiraling effect. If we can just hold off a second and a half, we can access our higher conscious mind, and then we can respond from love.
Mm-hmm.
A second and a half.
Yeah, and what I think is we want to clarify here is that you can't not experience fear. And you don't want to. That's
right.
There's
right.
no way you want to get
right.
rid of that.
Right.
But what most people fail to understand is that while fear is the automatic, you don't have to go, well, then that's the way it is because that's how I feel.
Yeah.
So I think this might be touching back on your idea that well-being is already there. We just got to uncover it.
Right.
That it's so many times I hear people say, you know, I feel fear. There's nothing I can do about it. And my response is, you're right. You feel fear. There's nothing you can initially do. But what do you do next? That is your choice.
Exactly. We have the choice to wait and respond. And this whole idea of getting the love we want. Noah Alcreef wrote a wonderful blog post about the pursuit of love. Being created by a big misunderstanding. We think the feeling that we want in life is created by receiving love. We think that feeling is all about receiving it, when in fact that feeling you want is actually created by giving love. An example I like to give, because most people can relate to this being a teenager, and sometime when you were a teenager, you maybe were experienced a crush on someone else who was having a crush on you, and you were experiencing this love. And if you remember what that felt like, that this person loved you, you experience this feeling of love, of being cherished, of feeling important, and we got the idea, oh, that's how we receive love. We get it from someone else. But then you have another friend that tells you that this person you really love is actually seeing someone else, and his love was someone else, and they were with this other person. And so you stop feeling all that love and you start feeling fear and hurt and anger. And I'm wondering what happened to all that love. Because you find out later that this friend that told you that just made it up because they wanted to date you. Mm-hmm. They liked you. They just made this up. That person that had a crush on you still has a crush on you. They still love you. But we can't receive it. We can't experience it. And we're not experiencing the love from this friend that told us that our friend, that the person we had a crush on was doing this. So here's two people that are sending us love, and we're not receiving it. The only time we felt the love was when we were giving it. When their love never changed. It was our love that was what changed.
So how does that fit for, let's say, a couple in trouble? How do they take that in and use that information?
I think extending love first, finding, and they may not be feeling it. They may be really angry. They may be in a place where they're just not feeling the love. What I find is that by acting in a loving way, if I'm in a little snitty fit with my mate and I let him get out the door in a place where I'm in displeasure, what I find the fastest thing to get me out of that is to immediately go to my phone and text a loving message. By the time I'm done writing the message, I'm in a different place. So the act of doing something loving. Now, that could be the act of just getting yourself back into a loving place. It could be maybe you water your plant or pet your dog or your cat. Bridging what you need to bridge to get so that you can do something loving for your spouse. The act of doing something loving will make you feel like you're receiving love.
You know, that one of the clear quotes for me, Paul, one of our earlier coaches who actually wrote one of our bonus books, says that his relationship changed when he stopped thinking about what can I get out of this or what am I getting out of this and switched it to what can I put into this.
Exactly. When we look at what we can put into it, what we can give, then we experience that very love that we're looking for.
Okay, so a couple of things that when I say that to people, one of the things they say is, I'm exhausted from putting in. I'm not getting out. And I think they might be missing a piece. What piece?
Well, part of it is there's a difference between true care and overcare. True care is when you're in true care, you get energized by it. You feel uplifted. You get energy from being in true care when you're caring for something. When you're in overcare, and you can't be in overcare about something you don't care about to begin with. When you're in overcare, it's depleting. It saps your energy. It takes away. So that's always a big alarm bell. If I'm feeling drained in any way, it tells me I'm in overcare here. I'm not helping the situation. I'm making the situation worse. So pulling back, going back to that compassion piece, having compassion for yourself and looking at what's the true care here, what's the care that I could give that would energize me instead of sap my energy.
Okay. And there are times I think we all would recognize as you say that the circumstance requires our overcare. Somebody's sick, you know, somebody needs us desperately, and we step in and we may be drained by that. But that's not what you're talking about. You're talking about day-to-day behavior. And I think what you're saying is sometimes it comes from a place of our own need, not of showing love.
Exactly.
So you talked early on. We've kind of stepped away from that. That the important thing is loving yourself.
Yes. Our capacity to love others, I really believe, is what's the word I'm looking for here? Our capacity for love is conditional upon our own ability to love ourselves. And that goes back to that separation piece. When I said when we think we're separate from another or from our source, we don't love ourselves. When we can see ourselves as one and be part of life and appreciate who we are for being in that, we have a much higher capacity for love. When we accept ourselves, we're not in judgment of others. When we're being kind to ourselves, it's really easy to be kind to another. And I think we can all dig down and find that example of when we felt love for ourselves. It's like a cup that you're filling with water. If you're constantly having to fill the cup up, that's draining. If you can't give love out of your cup because you keep having to fill it up. But if you filled your own cup with your own love, then it overflows effortlessly. And we're able to give a lot more love. And really, it's endless because it's overflowing.
Okay, so in some ways, hearing that and going, I don't even know how to start that. I like that idea. Mm-hmm. Just philosophically like that idea, or however they're going to mm-hmm. phrase it. It sounds good. What do they do? What's a one or two or maybe three things that they can do to start loving themselves?
I think there's a lovely exercise of, it's a practice where you just stop for a moment in a day and love yourself for whatever it is that you're being right now, right in that moment. It's like, I can love myself right now. And here's the cool part. If you go to love yourself and say, I can't love myself, love yourself for not being able to love yourself. It sounds funny, but the first day that I was making the bed, I had been practicing this about just consciously making a choice to love myself. And when I couldn't, loving myself for not being able to love myself. Ultimately, it kind of makes you laugh. You start to laugh. You get a little giddy. And after practicing this for about a week, I was making the bed and it came around the corner and I mashed my shin against the end of the bed, which I know better. I've had this bed for 30 years. I know not to do that. A week prior to practicing this consciously loving myself, I would have sworn at myself. I would have castigated and criticized myself for doing this, and the pain would have intensified. And what came out of my mouth was, I love you. I love you for doing this because you were trying to make the bed and you were in a hurry, and I love you anyway. I love you for doing that. And I'll tell you, the pain went away a lot quicker. And it surprised me. And I started laughing. It's like, wow, what an interesting shift after only a week of practicing that. Mm.
Okay, so that would give them a first step. Is there a kind of a follow-up to kind of reinforce that?
I think finding something in your day, before going to sleep every night, if you think about three things that went well that day, just you're falling asleep, what are three things that went well today and why? Now, my argument here would be that if you experienced something going well, you had to have been involved in some way. You either witnessed it, you might have been directly involved, it was something you specifically did, but even if it was something that went well, if you were there to witness it, even that is an accomplishment, because you were there to witness it, you were there to acknowledge it, and by remembering it, you're spreading the ripples in the pond of that good feeling. Mm. So that would be another exercise, is three things that went well today and why, so that you're giving yourself credit for those things that you accomplished or did well or responded well, or even if it was just, well, you know, my teeth got brushed. Well, you know, that was a good thing. And what did it take? Well, you know, it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't pulled the toothpaste and the toothbrush out of the cupboard and did it. I had to show up to do it.
You know, there's a distinction, I think, between loving yourself that way and the way a lot of us love ourselves by, you know, or try to love ourselves by trying to make everybody think a lot of us. You know, I love myself so much, I'm going to go buy a new car. I love myself so much, I'm going to have a new outfit. And we, you know, at some point recognize that it has some shallowness to it. But I think that's where people get lost. That you're talking about something that's an internal process. It has nothing to do with anybody external.
Exactly. It's 100% internal. Because again, going back to the externals, if we measure our success by how the world sees us, by external measurements, we will be chronically insecure. That is insecurity. When we measure our success by who we're being, when we're being authentically who we are, when we're showing up as who we are, that is inner security.
Let's take that one step further, because I think what a lot of people do is they look around at marriages and they say, okay, this is how we're supposed to be. And they judge themselves against that. And I think what you just said is that there is a danger point to that.
Oh yeah, that's comparison. And whenever we compare, we're probably going to lose. Whether we're comparing ourselves better or worse, we're going to lose if we're in comparing, because that's external.
It's A, external, and B, I think one of the things that we forget is we're comparing all of our internal dirt.
Right.
To their appearance.
Yeah. It's like comparing your life to somebody's Facebook.
Yeah.
Like, people don't write on Facebook about the things they don't want anyone to know about.
Yeah.
We can never really judge another person's relationship. I know that in my own family, I see how certain members treat other family members versus how they treat people outside the family. Well, the people outside the family think that this person acts like that all the time. Mm-hmm. They never see what happens behind closed doors, mm-hmm. and what happens when they're not in this public persona. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that makes a difficult place to be. I mean, we do all want some yardstick to say, how are we doing? And yet we get fixated on that yardstick.
Mm-hmm. And how we're doing really needs to come down to, who am I being? Mm-hmm. Who am I stepping up? What am I liking about myself right now? What am I doing right? Mm-hmm. And focusing, when we focus on what's right instead of what's wrong, it's like getting yourself back on that road. When that you hit that icy patch and you fall, and your car ends up in the ditch, by focusing on what's right, by focusing on what we want instead of what we don't want, that's what gets us driving back on the road again. Mm-hmm. Until the next thing throws us into the ditch. We're always going to have things throwing us into the ditch. It's how fast we get out that determines how happy we are. When we can, it's like a marriage that has stability, and the couple is highly developed in terms of their ability to connect and to be in their attachment skills. When they have something that comes up, it's not that the spouse never does anything that bothers them. It's that when something comes up, they get past it quickly. Mm. And that's the biggest difference. And it's about what you're focusing on. If you're focusing on what's wrong and what isn't working, or are you focusing on what's going well, and what would the solution be?
Now, here's a place that I just want to kind of point out that this, we get into habits of thought. And sometimes it's really hard to break that. And so one of the things we wanted to make clear, Nina, is that somebody might be listening to this and they're going, man, that is me. In fact, I would think that most people are going to be going, wow, I'm doing this. You know, I've got this external reference. My attitude is getting me down. And so what do I do? And so one of the options is to get a little coaching.
That's right.
So, Nina, there are going to be some people who say, yep, that connects with me. Nina, how would they connect with you and set up a coaching session to just kind of explore that with you?
Right. They can call me at 651-214-6000. 6803, and I'll be happy to get them scheduled. I'm on Central Time just to give them a little idea of my time. And they also could email. And my email is, it's spelled Nina, N-I-N-A, at couples, that's plural, C-O-U-P-L-E-S, therapy, T-H-E-R-A-P-Y, exposed, exposed.com. So either call 651-214-6803 or email, and I'll be happy to get you scheduled and work with you.
Great. And you probably have a website that you want to send people to also. So your website is?
The website is ninapottercoach.com or Nina, N-I-N-A-P-O-T-T-E-R, coach is C-O-A-C-H.com.
Okay, great. Nina, thanks for all that you've offered today. And my guess is you'll be hearing some from some people. And if not, hopefully they've internalized that message and at least are going, okay, I've got a choice on this attitude and I've got a choice on how I reach out and love the other person.
Great. Thank you so much, Lee.
Thank you. Okay, I hope you got a lot out of that interview with Nina. I hope you, Kimmy, maybe gave you some new realization, some new understanding of how what you are in the relationship, how you enter into the relationship, and how you view the relationship can actually change what your expectations are in that relationship and what you get out of that relationship. Those can transform your relationship. Now, if something in that struck a nerve with you, if you really went, wow, you know what, that speaks to me and I need to speak to Nina, the easiest way to get in contact with her is to email her at Nina, N-I-N-A, at couplestherapyexposed.com. That's Nina at couplestherapyexposed.com. If you have any problems, you can just catch me, Lee at SaveTheMarriage.com, and I'll make sure that message gets to her. Now, if this was a useful process for you to be listening to this, if you're finding these podcasts useful, I'm going to ask you to help us. We want to spread the word. We want to make sure that we get to as many couples as possible, because if you're like me, you've recognized how crucial, how important it is to save a marriage and how important that is for really the future generations. And so I want you to help me spread the message. Now, I know that some people still feel kind of self-conscious about that, but let me give you some easy ways of doing it. One is, if you listen on iTunes, if you're one of the people who is subscribed on iTunes, leave a review on iTunes. Go to your podcast, do a search, find me, and leave a review there, and let us know how we're doing. If you're listening on Stitcher or one of the other aggregates, leave the review there. Those help people find us. Also, if you're on Twitter, you can do it pretty easily by just giving us a little Twitter love. And all you have to do is type into your search bar on whatever browser you're on, SaveTheMarriage.com/love. That's SaveTheMarriage.com/love. And give us a little Twitter love. It'll give you a preset tweet that you can just send out to the world and let them know how to find us. Remember, you can also find me at SaveTheMarriage.com. If you don't have the system, please grab the system at SaveTheMarriage.com. My process is to help you not just stop a divorce, but save and improve your marriage. And if you're ready to get started really quickly with maybe a Kindle, my system is immediately downloadable. But if you want to check it out with a Kindle, remember, it's not the system, but it's going to give you three simple steps on how to save your marriage. And you can find that either in Kindle version or in softback by going to SaveTheMarriage.com/Kindle, K-I-N-D-L-E. And pretty much anything you have, you can read it or you can get it sent to you in the mail. Okay, that's it. If you have some ideas on what you would like to hear, or if you had some reactions to what was said today, please put those reactions in the comments below. But if you've got an idea you'd like to hear about on this podcast, just email me at podcast@savethemarriage.com. And that's a lot of the places I get my ideas for what's going to be coming up, because that tells me that it's about what you need. This is Lee Balcom wishing you the best as you continue to work to save your marriage.
You've been listening to Save the Marriage Podcast. For more information and help, please visit us at SaveTheMarriage.com.